Welcome to Parallel Quest, a podcast where two friends talk about the stories we love and share our personal stories of the impact they've had on our lives. I'm one of your hosts, Cody Haggard, and alongside, or maybe more accurately said, across the internet from me, my great friend, co-host, author, and virus survivor, Zach Butler. Zach, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing a lot better than I was last week. Going a little stir crazy.
Yeah.
Here last week in the studio, I spent a lot of time for the fans at home that are playing along. I got COVID, so it was my turn. Cody had it earlier in the year, and so then it was my turn to get it. And I spent a lot of time in this room. Just I forget who I was talking to, but I was telling him, I was like, I've watched more YouTube in the last like 5 days that I had in my entire life. So I was staying busy. I got some stuff done that I needed to get done with, you know, the books and some articles I wanted to write. But man, more than anything, I was sick a little bit, but it was more just, you know, you got to quarantine.
And yeah.
I got bored pretty quick after, you know, day three. I was like, all right, I thought it would be a great experience because I was like, look, I get to get stuff done. I get to like get my introvertedness on because I'm kind of an introverted guy.
Yeah.
And then that kind of wore off after the second day. So
yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was it is what it is. I'm a lot better now. Feel great. My scent and my taste is slowly coming back. Like
good.
I still can't.
Good.
Really smell something unless I get up close to it.
Yeah.
Or unless it's like a real strong smell, like garlic, I can really smell. But
yeah.
I know at the store, walking in, I could usually smell like the chicken and fries and everything. I can't smell that right now. So it's an interesting experience walking in to Chick-fil-A at the moment.
Yeah, it is. It's and it's such a strange virus. It affects so many people in so many different ways. But before we keep going on, I do want to mention, I've wanted to say this at the beginning of the podcast for a good, 3 months now. So we have timestamps in our podcast and on the YouTube videos. So if you guys ever want to jump around or go to certain topics, I try and go through and make, pretty substantial timestamps to show what we talk about at certain points. So if you want to jump around in the episode, feel free to do so. We encourage that, you know. Or if you want to stick around for the whole ride, we love that as well. But I've been wanting to say that at the beginning of an episode forever, and I always forget. And today, I finally remembered. So
episode whatever we're on.
Yeah, you know? we're like 60, I think we're 68, 69, 70, something somewhere in there.
Yeah.
I'll figure it out when I write up the official description.
Yeah, we finally got it out to you guys. So yes. There are timestamps. So if you want to skip the intro, move on to other things, actually get to the meat of it, because you know, some people like hearing us talk about our stories and our lives. Other people are like, dude, just get to the point. So you now can do that.
Absolutely. Not to say that there isn't any meat at the beginning of these podcasts, because I am going to bring up my latest incident of health. Because Zach had to battle a virus, I more have been battling a consequence of my own stupidity. And that is dealing with a broken foot for no good reason. And a couple weeks ago, Zach, I already told you this, but man, it's one of those things where it started off not so bad. Now it got a little bit worse. And I'll tell you why here in a second. But for those of you who don't know how I broke my foot, I did break it, right? And I was just goofing around with the kids, you know, just doing a little goofy dance move type of deal that I, you know, do all the time. Did a little hop, skip, step in the air, landed funny on my foot, and I could just hear it on my floor, the bone just crack. And it was like, oh gosh, that didn't feel good. And, you know, I went in for x-rays, came back, was broken, and 2 weeks have gone by at this point, and I went back for some more x-rays and found out, you know, they thought I'd be able to get through with just the little tiny, you know, inconspicuous shoe. They have now fully upgraded me to the walking boot that goes halfway up the leg.
No.
You know, so here I am with this walking boot. It's no fun, but it's just one of those things that happens where I'm at a point in life where for most of my life, I've always felt younger than I actually am. And here's the deal. Now I kind of feel older than I actually am, because this is still, like, I'm only 30, right? This is still kind of a fluke injury to happen at 30. Like, if I was in my 40s or 50s, I could understand. But, oh, man, if my bones are getting brittle like this at 30, I'm not optimistic for the future here, dude.
I mean, you're not warned about that at all when you hit 30, man. You're no. still, like, we were talking about, I was like, man, like, I still feel, you know, like, I could go out and play a high school football game at times. Like, I
sure,
think that
yeah.
I can. And then, like, honestly, the other day, it was like 2 days ago, I got home. Actually, I wasn't even done with work. I was, like, the last 2 hours of work, I was walking around. I was kind of starting to hobble a little bit. I'm like, man, my feet hurt. Like, I've been, like, out of this for a week, and my feet are already hurt. Like, I was picturing sitting down at my house in my chair and just kicking my feet up. That was kind of what was keeping me going through the day. I was like, oh, I'm just going to just get them up and kick off them shoes and just really enjoy, you know, just freeing my feet. And I was like, man, this is 31. Like, this is what do I have to look forward to right now physically? So I feel the pain, man. I mean, not to the extent of breaking my foot playing with my kids, but, you know,
just the slower,
I'll be there one day, I'm sure.
The slower recovery. How was your first day back to, you know, moving around a restaurant at a pretty rapid pace after you came back from COVID? How was that?
It wasn't too bad. Okay. It was because I try and get up early. I get up around 6 and I try and go to the gym before I start my day, because it's honestly probably one of the hardest things I do all day is just go and work out. And I know that if I don't go in the morning, I'm probably not going to go at all. And so I got a workout in, so I was feeling really good. It was just towards the end of that day, man. It was just an 8-hour day too. It was a normal day. Yeah. And I kind of started feeling a little drained. And I don't know if that was, you know, the COVID wearing off or I just hadn't moved. I mean, when I was sitting in here for a week, I could feel my back starting to hurt. I would get up out of my chair and I was like, oh my gosh, like my back was getting tight just from sitting for, you know, hours on end. And so that first day back wasn't too bad, but I was feeling it, man.
Okay.
And, you know, that it was really the third day back is when I was hurting. My legs were hurting. My feet were hurting. I couldn't wait to sit down in my chair. So yeah, it was that third day. But yeah, COVID's weird, man. COVID's weird.
Yeah, weird thing, dude. Weird thing.
Weird thing.
Just so glad to know that you, your wife, your little one are now out of the woods. Everyone's doing fine. That's
we all got through it.
And that's very exciting. But before we get into our main topic, so for those of you who are listening, didn't look at the title or anything like that, you just kind of listened blind, that is awesome. Today we are talking about the first book in the Kingkiller Chronicles called The Name of the Wind. And before we do that, we're just going to give you guys a little bit of what we are currently reading or watching, what type of entertainment we're into, and, you know, maybe if we'd recommend it to you or not. So, Zach, you know, what are you doing in your free time? You had a lot of it, you know, a few weeks, you know, about last week. So what are you doing in your free time? What are you reading, watching? What's going on?
Yeah, so I didn't get to watch too much because there is no television on this side of the duplex. So I kind of glad there isn't, but at the same time, I was like, man, I really could have gotten caught up on some shows I wanted to watch. But instead, I decided to watch, you know, a ton of YouTube, and I read 2 books. So that was great. So one of them that I read was the second book in the original Dune saga, Dune trilogy, Dune Messiah is what I read. And it was a Dune book. I love Dune. It's just it takes me a little bit to get into Dune. It's so heavy philosophically. I feel like every sentence is just layered with double meanings, and like the plot's always simple. It's just how, you know, Frank Herbert goes about executing that plot with his characters is always convoluted, because you think in your head he's a very good show don't tell writer. And mm-hmm. so he will allude to something, and a lot of the times it's in a vision or it's kind of hinted at, and you kind of think to yourself, I think this is what he's saying, but I'm not sure. And then, you know, 200 pages go by, and then the thing happens. You're like, oh, okay, good. That's actually what I thought it was. Or something completely different happens, and at least for me, I think to myself, oh boy, I was way off on that. I did not think that that's what he was talking about at all. So Dune Messiah, I would say it's still good. It's definitely not as good as Dune, but it was good. It was interesting because Frank Herbert's philosophy, or his philosophy in writing Dune, was he wanted to show the rise and fall of someone who attains power. And so Dune Messiah is what happens to Paul Atreides after he attains power. Spoiler for anyone who's not seen or read Dune. It's been out for a while. So it's what happens afterwards. Okay. And I will say it's not good. Paul does not take power well. And so Frank Herbert's famously said, like, any world leader or anyone with a lot of power should come with a warning label that says like harmful if used improperly or something. He basically is like, if you become very powerful, you're just power corrupts the easily corruptible. And so that's kind of the theme in Dune Messiah. So I read that. That was really good. I read Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke. He's the guy who wrote 2001 A Space Odyssey, which Stanley Kubrick then took and made famous. Childhood's End was great. It's an alien invasion story, but from a different perspective. It's an interesting plot. Basically, these aliens come to Earth. They're called the Overlords. They usher humanity into basically a golden era where it's essentially socialism has happened across the world. Anyone can do anything they want. No one worries about anything. And then the children start to disappear. So it's an interesting story. I really enjoyed that one. And then the final thing that I read is my next book, The Beast of Big Bear Forest.
Read through it.
I read through it. All the edits are done. All the final everything is done. All I'm doing is waiting for my formatter to get it back. This one took a lot longer because I kind of got behind. Thank goodness I got COVID, because then I could edit everything and read it all. So honestly, within the coming week, so this will drop sometime the week of the 14th of November. So the following week, just before Thanksgiving, I'm hoping to have, you know, The Beast of Big Bear Forest out. Look for it on our page at steellakestudio.com. Or I'll have the cover up on my Facebook page if you guys want to check it out there. Or if you go to the Facebook page, the Steel Lake Studio Facebook page, the cover will be up there and a little synopsis. So be on the lookout for that. This one has taken me a while, but I wanted to take time with this one because I want to get better as a writer with each book. So Beast of Big Bear Forest was my final read of the week.
Nice, man.
So why don't you tell me what you've been watching? What have you been reading?
Well, I have been reading the first book in Wheel of Time, The Eye of the World. The show is launching at the end of the week here, and I at least want to have the first book read before I watch the show. And I got a little bit behind on my reading. I still have like 500 pages to go. But we'll see. We'll see how I do. So I've been reading that, and man, I gotta be honest. Like there is so much in this book that I don't know how I didn't get into this series earlier. Like even a little over a quarter way through the book, it's like, oh man, this is really like a series that was written for a guy like me. So it's very much like it feels it has a lot of that same weight and feeling of like Lord of the Rings, you know, whereas other fantasy, more modern fantasy, I feel like tries to be, have this mix of like high fantasy, but also like almost this contemporary type of dialogue, feel how the world interacts, because it makes it easier to read. But, you know, Wheel of Time is a good jump in. It is not necessarily as archaic as Lord of the Rings feels, right? But it just, it feels fantasy. Like, it just, like, through and through, it's like, man, this feels like a spiritual successor, feels very influenced by Middle Earth, and can't believe I'm only reading this for the first time at age 30. And so far, like it a lot, and I think it has potential to be a great show. And I hope it is. I really do. I hope it's great. So anyway, that's what I'm reading now. I'm really enjoying it. And then I've actually been playing through all the old Halo games because they have a collection on the Xbox Game Pass where all of them, Halo 1 through 4, are part of this collection. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to play through them. There's a new one coming out here in a few weeks that looks really, really good. And, you know, I always kind of appreciated Halo, especially from like the campaign aspect, but I never played past 2, right? I like after 2, I was done because I was never good enough at the multiplayer to really kind of stick with the games. But you know, I have a new appreciation for that series. I forgot like how ahead of its time, really, Halo was. I'm sure if people went back and played the original now, you'd think like you maybe not be as impressed. But man, games just weren't doing what that game did at the time that it came out, at least on console. So, so that was pretty cool. I mean, I've been enjoying that. It's a lot of fun, and I would definitely, if anybody out there has like an Xbox or a gaming PC, get the Game Pass and get that Master Chief Collection. It's a lot of fun. So,
and for anyone who's interested in a really long history and in-depth talk about Halo, you could go back and listen to one of our episodes where I basically talk at Cody for 3 hours about Halo. So if you're really into it.
Zach schooled me on Halo, and he was definitely the bigger Halo fan in that episode, but I don't know. I'm becoming a bigger Halo fan as the days go by.
That's good. Yeah. I only played up to 4, though, so I never played after that, and I was kind of disappointed by 4. So I'm interested, honestly, to see what the new one's going to be like, because I was a huge, huge Halo fan back in the day, and after, you know, Bungie left, my heart left with it. This new one might be good.
The marketing behind this one has been getting back to form. That is basically what they've been saying through all the marketing. Because I think the company that took over after Bungie kind of, they tried to go with trends rather than really honing in on what made Halo special, right? I think the reason why people still really liked Halo 3 a lot and played it a lot when Call of Duty was kind of up and coming was the fact that it still felt different. Mm-hmm. And then from what I've heard, it sounds like Halo 4 tried to be Call of Duty in Halo. That's not what the game was, you know? So anyway, supposedly they're trying to get back to form. They've been working on this game for 8 years, so it better be good.
You hope so.
And hey, if you got a gaming PC or an Xbox around the house for $10 a month, you get Game Pass and the new Halo games included with that. So that's a pretty darn good deal.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're going to transition now. We're getting the stage set for Name of the Wind. But in order to set the stage, what we like to do to have a little bit of fun is to go back in time to when the book was published, which was the year 2007. And Zach has written up some stuff about the state of the world in 2007. And so we're going to talk a little bit about 2007. Because when I read this book and I saw it was published in 2007, I was surprised, really, because to me it feels like a newer series, but 2007, at this point, is 14 years ago. Like, geez, you know? And so as the book felt fresh and new to me, it's actually decently old at this point, right? You know, it's 14 years old, almost 15. And here we go. We're going to talk a little bit about the state of the world in 2007. Zach, take it away.
Yeah, so in 2007, I believe we had another intellectual property happen in 2007. So for those of you that are, you know, have picture perfect memory, maybe one or two of these might be similar to that one. But I couldn't remember which episode we did and which ones of these that we used. So these might be a repeat, but that episode was so long ago that I was like, you know what? You know, this will still feel like it's the first time. So in 2007, the Apple iPhone was first announced. Think about that. That is how long ago the iPhone first came out. So for everyone that's on, you know, the new iPhone that basically records Hollywood movies on it, 2007 was the first year it was announced, and it originally sold for $599. It was put, and it pushed over a million units in less than 3 months. So it sold over a million phones in less than 3 months. It was one of the hottest selling items of all time for $599, which, to be honest, I saw $599. I'm like, that's not honestly that far off from what phones sell for today. So the price of phones has kind of gone up a little bit. It's not really all that much. So,
well, in
$599. Go ahead.
The thing about phones, too, was, right, we all thought that. And to this price coming out like $599 is kind of astronomical, right? Because we all kind of were stuck in that 2 year upgrade model of phones, right? Where, you know, if you came from a home like I did, it was like, no, you're just getting whatever phone is free with the 2 year upgrade. Like, hey, that's what you get, you know, whatever it is, that's your phone. And so that was not an option with the iPhone, right? And I think it was. Even with like a 2 year upgrade, the phone still costed like $250 or something like that. Because one of the things that has happened over the years is there was that thing where they kind of cracked down on the phone companies, where basically they made you separate the costs of phone and networking your service, basically, because I guess what they found out is that they were continuing to charge people for phones, like within the bills of phones, like your phone bill, when people, you know, had well paid off their phone or whatever. So they had to kind of get rid of all those secret charges. And that's why phones now, you look at the price of a phone, you're like, oh man, $650. What happened to that free 2 year upgrade? Well, that free 2 year upgrade you were paying for, you just didn't know it. And so. That's why, especially in 2007, a $600 phone was like, not happening. Not happening in my house.
Well, there you go. Some cell phone history.
Yeah.
Cody.
There you go.
I did not know that. In 2007, I still had you remember the chocolate, the phone that would like slide up and had like the keyboard right there. I was still rocking that thing.
Yeah.
So 2007, I saw the iPhone come out. I was like, whoa, this is the future, man.
I had a lime green phone and I thought it was sweet because it had like it flipped up and had a sideways keyboard. And I'm like, And I
remember that. Yes.
I love that it was lime green because I always knew which phone was mine. Because a lot of people had the same phone. And I was the only guy with a lime green phone. I got made fun of for it a lot, but I didn't care. I always knew it was my phone, never got lost. And
you had a keyboard on it, man.
I had a keyboard, dude. And I could text on that thing.
Man, yeah.
I was good. I was lightning.
Something else that happened in 2007. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Published, and I remember that summer. It was a great summer. Mm-hmm. I remember I was coming back from a missions trip in Louisiana, and we stopped at a Barnes and Nobles that we all knew was on our way back. So the book came out while we were on the missions trip. We picked a Barnes and Noble on the way back, stopped there to get our pre-ordered copies in, I forget what state it was. Mm-hmm. And I remember all of us, the whole ride back, it was silent. Like, which is crazy when you have a van full of teenagers, but it was silent all the way back. No music, nothing. We were all just reading. It was a great summer, man. They had a great book. That was a great way to end, you know, the Harry Potter series. So,
yeah.
Deathly Hallows comes out.
Where does Deathly Hallows rank for you in the Harry Potter books? Where would it rank for you? Is it a top three? The number
it's probably
one?
Top three. I was honestly thinking it's probably... number one is, for me, is Prisoner of Azkaban. That's my favorite one.
Okay.
And then probably then the first one, and then Deathly Hallows is kind of how I rank them in my head.
Nice. Deathly Hallows is also my number three, but my one and two
it's,
are a little
it's
different.
It's so good, man. It's so hard to write good endings, and to write a satisfying ending, even we kind of, I mean, you didn't know if it was going to be a good ending, but to write a good ending, like the good outcome and write it well, man, that's talent. So we'll have to do Deathly Hallows once we muster up the courage to do the next
one. The next one is Prisoner of Azkaban, which is my personal favorite. For me, it's Prisoner of Azkaban, Half-Blood Prince, Deathly Hallows. So,
yeah. So that might go better because we both love Prisoner of Azkaban.
I do like that one quite a bit. I just got so much
we're
about
still
Chamber
licking
of
our wounds from the last one. So we got to get back on that horse eventually. Bummed but in 2007, the Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End is released. I wanted to include this because I hated this movie. I hated it. I was a fan of Pirates of the Caribbean, The Black Pearl. I was like, man, this franchise has got some, you know, got something behind it. It's got interesting characters. The whole pirate genre is not really done much in movies, and they made it cool again. And then at World's End, I remember sitting there watching it going, I have no idea what is happening in this movie. Like, this is just, like, I'm not interested. Like, they're trying to do too much. The characters are no longer the characters I remember them being. I hated this movie, but I hated it so much that I remembered when I saw it on the list of pop culture things, I was like, oh my gosh, I remember that movie.
Oh man, I was in extreme fan denial over this movie where it was one of those things where I liked one and two so much that I convinced myself that this was a pretty good movie, and even to the point of where when it came out on DVD, I actually bought it. And
oh my gosh.
I gotta be honest, dude. This movie is not good. And and this is case in point of you get attached to a franchise, you want to like it, and so then you act like certain installments are better than they are. And that's what happened with me with Pirates of the Caribbean. And that's what I think what happens to a lot of people when there is just a movie or a book that is just objectively not as good. It comes out and people try and defend it. And it's like, we get it. You're in fan denial. I understand. You don't want it to be bad, but it is. And that was me with At World's End, dude.
Oh, man. You might have been the only person liking that movie at that time.
I was in a little bit of fan denial on Last Jedi for a little bit, too.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. But, yeah, so that terrible piece of trash happened in 2007. Christmas, this is just cool. Christmas was on a Tuesday, which meant for many people, that was a great year because it was a four-day weekend.
Those are always nice.
It was a great, it's always good when it falls on a Tuesday. So 2007 also gave us the first look. And now this is a household name, but at the time, this was, you know, the future. 2007 gave us the first look at the Tesla Roadster. It had a car show before it went in production in 2008. So this is the first time we heard, or at least the general population heard of Tesla and electric cars and what they could do. And I remember it was like, what are they doing? Like, this is not going to work. This is just a gimmick. And here we are in 2021. And you kind of wish you would have bought Tesla stock back in 2007. So,
right.
So that went away that people did not expect. I remember seeing that, or at least, you know, news highlights of it, and then I was like, well, all right, well, I've seen, because I used to go to car shows with my dad, and I remember always seeing the electric car concepts and being like, oh man, if that was actually a thing, that would be cool. And Tesla actually did it. So here we are, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's get into our main topic, man. This is what the people came for.
Yeah.
They came for The Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. Cody, this is the first time you read it, and you kind of said at the beginning that you expected this to be more recent just because of the language and the themes, and just a lot of tropes are very current fantasy. But this is an old book, man. This is 2007.
It's getting there.
Yeah, but it has held up. It has held up over time. This is why in a lot of people's lists, if you go online and just type in top 10 fantasy series of all time, or if you go to Reddit and follow their subpage on fantasy, this is a constant, this book, but this series is constantly in the top five, honestly, or top 10. But for a lot of people, this is a book that they love. It was introduced to me by someone who said, this is my favorite fantasy book, and this guy is a fantasy guru. And so I was like, wow, man, this must be a really good book. So just to give you some stats real quick, it got a 4.51 out of 5 on Goodreads, which is pretty good.
That's good.
It's really good for a fantasy book, because I would say Goodreads is probably pretty harsh on fantasy. From just my experience, fantasy is just such a, honestly, an oversaturated genre that it's hard to write a recent fantasy book that isn't just like, this is just a copy of Harry Potter, this is just a copy of Lord of the Rings, it's just whatever. People tend to grade fantasy books harder, in my opinion. So I think that's a pretty good score on Goodreads. It's
yeah,
number
but how
nine.
Many people are ripping off Shakespeare's story in literary fiction? Come on now. You know what I'm saying? Like everyone loves a good knockoff of some type of Shakespearean trope that's been done a million times. But if it's literary fiction, it gets a pass, right?
Hey, we're looking at you, Lion King. All right. We know that you ripped off Shakespeare. All right.
That's not what I was looking at, but.
So this is, like I said, number 9 on Reddit's top fantasy novels. The King Killer Chronicles is on the top. The way Reddit does it is by series, but most people on Reddit would say The Name of the Wind is the best out of the two that are out. So it's number 9 on there. And I went on Amazon because it had a lot of reviews anyways, and it was 4.7 out of 5 on Amazon. Amazon is, honestly, in my opinion, once again, a good resource for finding out what ratings on books are. I think that
Amazon also owns Goodreads.
They do also own Goodreads. But I like using Amazon purely for book reviews or book ratings. I don't always trust their product ratings on other things, but with books I mainly do, because they started out as a book company. So a lot of, and plus they have, you know, the Kindle universe and everything. So people like reading from Amazon, so I trust them. So I'll go through a couple of these fun facts, and then we'll get into our discussion. What's cool about this is because I have the 10-year edition of, I'm going to hold this up for people that are following along with the YouTube page. If you guys are over on YouTube, you guys can see this book. It is a beautiful book.
Oh, yeah.
It's a 10-year edition. And what's cool about it is inside the book and the back, it's got like a glossary of how to pronounce everything. It's got, you know, pictures and everything about the currency and the world. Patrick talks about how he came up with ideas. And so I got a lot of like extra stuff, just how he came up with the world of, honestly, I don't even know what the world's called, to be honest. But it's the world that Kavoth, who's the main character, lives in. He kind of talks about it. So when Patrick Rothfuss, who, if you ever see a picture of him, he looks like a guy who writes fantasy books. So this is not a shocker that he wrote a best-selling fantasy book series. This dude has one of the most epic beards I've ever seen. So he wrote The Name of the Wind while he was studying for his bachelor's degree in English. And when he first submitted this book, it was rejected by the editors because it had, at the time, in 2006, 2007, too many fantasy tropes. They're like, this is too tropey. This is literally just... And whenever you think of fantasy, this is what people expect to see. This is just nothing new. And so he was like, all right, this is too cliche. So he went back, he tweaked some things, and then he submitted it later on after finishing his bachelor's degree. And having not changed all that much about the actual story structure, and it is now hailed as one of the best fantasy novels of all time. And to give a very, you know, short summary of what the book is about. It's about an orphan boy who becomes a wizard and has to fight a dragon. That is like the first book. And right there, that's just like, okay, that's literally every hero story, every fantasy story you can think of. And so Patrick talks about that in the book at the beginning of how he got it submitted. And he's like, I'm not sure if I learned much from like the editing process of this all. He's just like, I just submitted it at a later time and it got published.
But if so, you read it, yes, the tropes are there, but it doesn't feel like a tropey fantasy novel. Talk about that a little later, but I think that's actually one of the strengths. If you read it and you get immersed in it, it doesn't feel tropey, even though it has a lot of tropes. But
yeah, it does a great job of balancing what is expected and then giving it a fresh look or a new flavor, if you want to say that. We'll talk about that in a sec. Just a couple more quick fun facts here. The book also goes by a second name. We've talked about it, we've mentioned it a couple times. It's called The Kingkiller Chronicle Day One. So the first book is Day One, and it has a sequel called The Wise Man's Fear, and that's called Day Two. And then there's a planned third Day Three book, I think it's like the Door of Stone or something that's been planned. This is also one of those series, guys, where we've been waiting a while for this third book. We're not on George R. R. Martin time yet, but we're knocking on that door. So Patrick is working on it. He occasionally comes out with videos and talks at conferences and stuff about it. But he's a perfectionist. And he even says that in the book, in my edition of the book, he says he's a perfectionist. So when you're dealing with a perfectionist and they're dealing with, you know, kind of their life's work, we're going to be waiting some time. So once again, we've picked a series here that has not finished yet. So I'm still waiting on the third book.
Now he and George R. R. Martin are technically in a race to get their next book finished because they both came out in 2011, Dance with Dragons and Wise Man's Fear.
So, oh no, it's been 10 years for both.
Get it done first?
Oh no.
But Rothfuss has said it's a trilogy, right?
He has said it's a trilogy. And actually, there's one other book in this series that came out it came out between Wise Man's Fear and today in 2001. It's a side story of one of the characters that's in the book. So he was writing and did publish another book, kind of like what George R. R. Martin's done. He's published other books in his world, but he's not actually published what everyone is waiting for, which is the next book in the series.
Right.
This I thought was cool because Cody and I love board games. We're huge fans of board games, went to Gen Con, love all that kind of stuff. So in the tabletop game, for those who are familiar with the King of Tokyo and King of New York series, the Dracus, which is the dragon in the book of The Name of the Wind, is a playable monster that was released at Gen Con the year that one of these board games came out as a special promotional character for when The Wise Man's Fear came out. So the Dracus is now a playable character in that board game in honor of Patrick Rothfuss, who also loves playing board games. And he looks like a guy who likes playing board games. It's fitting. It's cool, you know, the crossover.
Yeah.
So that is some fun facts about The Name of the Wind. I guess, Cody, why don't you give us, since this is the first time both of us have read it, but why don't you give us a summary? Because I don't think I've given a summary of what the book is, an actual summary of what the book is about. So why don't you let the people know what the summary is?
Yeah, I'll do a quick summary here. This summary will contain spoilers. So if you're looking for no spoilers for Name of the Wind, you can always come back and listen to this podcast later. Typically, since we do a retrospective on our discussions here, we just have to talk about spoilers because it's kind of the best way to get discussions out. So if you're new here, welcome. If you care about spoilers, you know, read Name of the Wind and then come back. But if you want to hear us talk about the story and then consider whether or not it's worth your read, that's fine too. Just don't blame us if we spoil anything. Although this is a type of story where I don't think spoilers would ruin it, because it's really not a story that revolves around big reveals or plot twists or anything like that. Even though there are small things in there, this is more about a journey of a boy who goes through catastrophe and works extremely hard to get his life in the place that he wants it to be. Nothing comes easy for him. And that's basically what we have. We have here, the story opens up in an inn. Just like every good fantasy tale, there has to be an inn involved. And I love that because it's a trope, and it's a trope that I love. I love the inn being a place of sanctuary, a place of like, this is where the plan is going to happen, or this is where the story is going to start. I love that. It's a great starting point. I've always enjoyed it. And so, anyway, it starts off with a innkeeper whose name, he goes by Coat, K-O-T-E, he goes by Coat, and he has this inn, and there's this man who shows up at his inn who wants to take down the chronicles or the stories of a legendary figure named Kvothe. He is the most famous wizard to ever live, and he feels like he has dwindled down to where Kvothe could be, and he thinks that Coat, this innkeeper, is Kvothe. And there's some things that happen conversation-wise where it tries to mislead him, but it just, nothing really comes of it, I believe. Right, doesn't he end up leaving or something? At first,
the chronicler, he ends up leaving, and
the chronicler ends up leaving. He gets attacked while he is on the road, and then he's rescued and brought back in, and then Kvothe decides to tell him the story, and we are introduced to this mysterious evil at the beginning, to these spider-like creatures that
Skrail, that
attack a passerby. And Kvothe is very concerned about this, and we're not 100% sure why. We obviously know it's bad. We don't hear anything else about them throughout the whole entire book, but I'm sure they're important because you're made to feel like they're important. And so I haven't read the next book, so I don't know if they come into play later on or not. But anyway, so then basically what happens, the chronicler is in this inn. He spends the entire day with Kvothe and his, what is his name?
Bast.
His
helper.
His helper, Bast, who is a...
His apprentice, actually.
I actually looked this up. This is kind of like extra book material. He's like a fairy type of creature. He's a fae, right? That's what it's called. And so his relationship with Kvothe is one that you see, but you're really not told much about it. So you kind of have to, you know, make some implications based on how you see the scenes plan out, right? And so Kvothe starts telling a story. He basically tells the story about how he grew up as part of a troop. His parents were troopers, the entertainment kind, not the military kind, T-R-O-U-P, E-R. And they go around, they tell stories, they play songs, they do plays, performances. And Kvothe has been a part of this his whole entire life. He's grown up in it. And he's very, very talented singing and a very talented lute player. But even with how talented he is, his father is much more talented than him, far beyond his talent, right? And so anyway, what ends up happening is one night there is a blue flame that Kvothe sees from distance off, and he comes rushing back to his camp, and he sees a group of people there who have killed everybody. Everybody in the town and everyone in the troop and the camp that they had. And these mysterious figures are believed by Kvothe to be the Chandrian. In fact, the story confirms that they are the Chandrian, which is this, like, I don't even know how to describe them. They almost kind of remind me of, like, Death Eaters in a way, but more mysterious.
Yeah, they're like a legendary evil group of people from old times.
Think about, like, you know, like a dark evil that can appear just as quick as they vanish, right? They're like, you know, they appear, they strike, and then they're gone, right? It's kind of like how lightning would strike. This is an evil that appears, they do whatever, typically bad, and then they're gone. And so then Kvothe, he obviously goes through a serious state of depression, right? He's lost his parents. He doesn't know what to do. The only thing that he has is his father's lute. And at this point, is it broken?
His lute does. No, it is not. It doesn't break until he gets to, the first town that he arrives at. I forget the name of it. It's
I can't remember the name of the town either.
It's a pretty significant town, honestly. Yeah. It's in my book. But, while you're talking, I'll look it up.
But I'll give a quick synopsis here, and then we can talk more about the details of what happened. So essentially what he wants to do is he wants to find a way to get into the Arcane Academy because he wants to study the arcane arts. And he is on this journey to try and get there because he was mentored for a time by a man named Benjamin, who basically said that Kvothe has what it takes to be a scholar, to be a legend, to really master, to be a master of the Arcanum. And so that's kind of what he even wants to do before the great catastrophe, before the incident. He kind of has his mindset. Mm-hmm. He's 11 at the time. And so what he does is he journeys and he finds himself in a city, a big city nearby. Can't remember what it's called.
Tarbian is the main city. Yeah.
Tarbian's the main city, or that's where he goes first?
Tarbian is where he goes first. He ends up at the university, which is right across the street or right across the river from that other major city.
Okay. So he ends up in Tarbian, where he becomes a homeless child and kind of gets into scruffs with other kids who are like in gangs, right? There's these little types of gangs around this village, and basically you have these chapters that are dedicated to Kvothe just trying to survive on the streets as a kid, and a sad incident that happens is his father's lute ends up breaking in all of this. And I know that it seems like a weird thing to keep bringing up this lute, but it's very significant because he's musically inclined, it means a lot to him, and it's going to be the thing that going forward is going to be able to put him in a position to actually do the things he wants to do. And he lives in Tarbian for a time, and he finds a way to get out. He travels with a band, and while he's traveling, he meets this young woman named Denna, who he's just starstruck with from the very beginning. And they were close, and they chatted, and they flirted, and all this stuff for like 3 days. Then a new person kind of enters the caravan, and then she kind of takes to that guy, and he's a musician, right? And he plays a little bit, and really, you know, he thought. Then our main character Kvothe thought that's what impressed her, and so he decides to kind of take a stab at it, and it was one of those things where he didn't end up getting the girl. The girl got away. And and he goes, and he gets into the academy with very like little to his name. It's expensive mm-hmm. to go to this school. He doesn't know how he's going to pay for it. And because he's so bright and because he's so talented and because he has studied and studied and Benjamin mentored him well, he was able to get into the academy for his first semester and not have to pay anything in the beginning. And so then his journey really begins of becoming an arcanist, and it's always tales of getting into quibbles with a really annoying adversary named, man, his name just left.
Ambrose.
Me. Ambrose, that's right. Ambrose, who is basically your stereotypical rich kid who's there and comes from money, always going to be there, and nobody really likes him. But still, because he has money and he's talented, he's just that guy, right?
He's the Malfoy of the story, man.
He just very much
comes from privilege.
Malfoy, yep.
He's not really great at school. He's just there because he's rich and he's learning. And the Arcanum, the university, is where all these students come and try to learn different aspects. And it's not so much like wizardry. A lot of it is like just learning different aspects of, you know, becoming a scholar or becoming someone who's really good at tinkering with machines. And so that's one thing I liked about this book was it wasn't straight up like I'm learning potions and I'm like it felt more grounded in reality.
Sure.
Other than, you know, the naming of things, which eventually he becomes interested in. But sorry, didn't mean to derail you there.
No, that's fine. And I'm not going to get into like a bunch of details because, I mean, it would take forever. But essentially what happens from this point forward in the book is it is the journey and the story of Kvothe trying to stay as a student in the academy while trying to get money in order to stay in the academy. So the book actually is very mundane at points. And he gets an opportunity to be able to get a loan. He's going to take a loan just to pay his tuition from a kind of seedy individual who we don't really know how she gets her finances and all and all of that. But she makes deals with people who basically she's like a cash and loan type of place.
Like she really is just like a loan shark.
What's her name?
Debbie.
I was going to say, I know it starts with
she's
a D.
She's one of my favorite characters. She's so funny.
She's very curious. And so anyway, he gets a loan, but instead what he decides to do is he takes a little bit more of a loan than he thinks that he should because he wants to buy himself a loot. And not even a nice one, a used one, which he has to haggle down the price for because he knows that if he could get this loot, he can play, he can practice, and he can start to make money off of this because he knows how to entertain. And a life groundbreaking incident happens. He's had a rough time at the academy. Ambrose has gone after him, pranked him, made him get banned from the archives where he really wants to study because he wants to find out more about the Chandrian. He took a candle back there, which is a big no-no, and like an open candle. It's got to be a closed lantern. No open candles in the archives. Catch the whole place on fire. And so he's banned, right? And so he had a rough going there. Ambrose is kind of always after him. He has a teacher who doesn't like him, who's always trying to get him expelled. And so by day, Kvothe has a rough time. And by
the
night,
the way you explain it makes it sound so much like Harry Potter at times. It's like, yes, that's Snape. Yes, that's
There's a lot of there's a lot of parallels between this and Harry Potter, but also very, very different in the
There's no headmaster, though. Okay, there's like 10 chancellors that run this whole thing.
There are. And the one who he ends up getting close with at the end there feels a lot like Dumbledore, though, in some ways. What's the goofy guy's name?
The guy does the naming. Loden? Is it Loden?
Elodin. Yeah. Okay. So here we go. We're moving. And he gets this loot and he ends up being able to put on a show and has the performance of his life at a place called the Aeolian, which he goes and there's a lot of rich people who go there who might be willing to make him a patron, right? Basically pay him for his services to come and play at their house or or parties or whatever that might look like. And he needs to get his golden pipes, which essentially means he wears these golden pipes around and it's a symbol to the rest of the world like, hey, I got golden pipes at the Aeolian. I can play anywhere, anything, anytime for anyone. And he plays, and it's the best written scene of the whole entire book, his performance at the Aeolian, and he performs a very difficult song to perform, but it's a duet. And so in this duet, he just kind of stops at his part and just waits for somebody to sing. And it has to be a female voice. It's a female voice duet. And he hears from the distance somebody singing. And in the scene, we don't know who it is. He doesn't see who it is, but he continues his performance. He plays, and it's just, it's a show stopper, right? You have emotions all throughout the audience, the tears. People didn't even know whether or not they should clap because it was so good, right? And then we
he broke a string.
That's right. That's why it was so impressive, because he played it with one less string. And we find out he gets his golden pipes, and everyone is being kind to him. There's this master, I can't remember his name. He's kind of a goofy old man who comes and plays silly songs at the Aeolian, but he's got a lot of money. He ends up giving he ends up giving Kvothe basically enough money to cover his loans, which was really neat. And then we come to find who the duet partner was in this solo. It's the same girl from the road, the journey.
Denna.
And this is where the story kind of takes another shift. Now the story transitions from not just being about Kvothe at the academy and playing and performing, but now it is a story of a young man pursuing the love of someone who he is awestruck with. And the two just can never really meet up, right? It's just they always are missing each other. But there are moments where they meet up, they hang out, they go on five-hour walks and talk under the stars. And so it ends up with the two kind of, it's one of those things, will they, won't they? And it feels like it's a big won't they. It's never going to happen again. And then an incident happens where Kvothe hears from somebody in the inn which he lives talking about an incident at a wedding where people just were killed at a wedding. It was a very mysterious thing. No one had heard about it. And so Kvothe decides to go on a journey and find out what went on here, because it sounded like a Chandrian attack. And so he shows up and he checks it out. And he gets into the inn, he starts asking questions, and he's asking, you know, if there's any way that he could talk to the one person who survived this. And guess who the one person who survived this wedding was? Denna. It's just, it's one of those things. It's just, she's always there. When
comes in and out of his life.
Comes in and out of his life, and always there at the biggest moments. And so then what happens is Denna and Kvothe are now together, not really emotionally, but like partners in crime at this point, or partners in adventure, I should say. And they investigate what's going on at this wedding where all these people died. And they can't really figure out what happened. They're not sure. And Kvothe doesn't really have any huge leads as to what this was. Was it a Chandrian attack or what? And then they start seeing these blue flames in the night. They talk to this wanderer who...
Pig herder.
Yeah, he's a pig herder who talks about strange things happening in the woods. And while Denna and Kvothe are in the woods at night, they see these blue flames coming out. And these blue flames are coming from a dragon called a Drakus. Or, you know, Drakus is the better term, not necessarily dragon.
Yeah.
But
it's basically a dragon.
They find the Drakus. And, you know, Kvothe is very convinced, like, oh, these things aren't very violent and all that. And then they keep tracking it down, and then it shows up and kind of attacks where they're staying at in the middle of the night, and wondering, like, why is this thing so aggressive? Come to find out, there is this substance in the world of Name of the Wind called the Sweet. Is that what it's called?
That's the nickname for it. Yeah.
Sweet. Which
it's basically like
it's
heroin.
Like heroin. Like yeah. That's exactly what it is. And so there's these trees that are producing this stuff called the sweet, which acts a lot like heroin, or acts a little bit more like meth, to yeah. be honest.
Yeah. Well, meth for the Dracus, for sure.
Yeah.
Does not chill him out.
True. Yeah. And so what happens is they're trying to figure out what it is that's making this thing go crazy, and they end up in this room where they have all this sweet stored. And what ends up happening is Denna ends up tasting the stuff. And a lot of it. And she starts to get really high. And there's worries that she might die.
Yeah, she overdosed.
And so Kvothe has to take care of her and then also take care of the Dracus. And honestly, I can't remember exactly how they end up killing this thing. But
so
they do.
Yeah, they take it. It doesn't follow them. It sees the town where they originally were camping at, and it's a fall festival at the town.
Yeah.
And the Dracus is drawn to like lights and big fires. And naturally, and now that it's like all methed out, it's like super attracted to this right. stuff. And so it sees the town light their fall festival bonfire that they do every year. And it's just like, yeah, I want some of that.
Yeah, you want
so that. So it goes and just levels this town by accident.
Yes.
And Kvothe ends up killing it by binding the, there's like a big clock or something on one of the buildings. And he ends up binding it to the Dracus. And for the fans out there, I'm probably saying that wrong, but he uses a binding, which is like essentially the magic of this world, and he ends up killing it by basically throwing like a giant clock on top of it.
Yeah,
because that's how the magic works. It's very scientific. It's very like you have to use some sort of energy in order to move elements, and the way that the really good binders can do things is they use the energy and their own blood, the heat from their own blood, in order to do that. But the problem is if you do that too much, or if you use too much of your heat to manipulate elements, you can die because you get binding sickness. And that's basically like you go into hypothermia and die. So yeah. Kvothe ends up doing that and killing the Dracus, saves the town, saves Denna, you know, the happy ending. And so that is that's generally close to how the book ends.
Yeah,
because then he heads back. Yeah, he goes back to town and everything. And what's so cool about like this book is like that's the general overview of kind of the general plot, but you have just these, you know, small stories planted throughout. Like Kvothe at the university pulling pranks on Ambrose and meeting his friends Sim and Willem or something, and like all throughout the book. Because what I love the most about this book and why it's so like why I hold it dear to me is because you get Kvothe at the beginning of the book and you learn from the chronicler, like, this guy is a legend. Like, he did this. Like, he, like, when he first meets him, you're like, you're the guy that did blah, 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 blah. Like, he lists all these things that, as the reader, you have no idea what any of that means, but you're like, wow, this guy must be, like, the man. He's done all this stuff. And what you learn throughout the book is that Kvothe hasn't done really all that stuff. He allows the fame of certain events to go beyond what actually occurred,
yeah.
But he allows it to happen in order to build his fame. Because one thing he talks about at the very beginning when he goes into the university is like, I need to make a name for myself because I'm the poor guy. I don't want to be the guy that I was in Tarbian, who's just like this runt on the road. I want to be like, I need to make my name. Like, if I don't have money, I need to have a name. And so he allows his pranks and his antics and the stories that start, you know, coming around him or start forming around him, he allows them to expand into legends, mm-hmm. and he actually kind of fuels that fire. So what's fun to hear is, like, he's at one point called, like, the Bloodless. Like, that's one thing that he calls himself, like, Kvothe the Bloodless. It's because when he got in trouble at the university, part of the punishment was he had to get whipped. And so when he got whipped, he didn't bleed. And everyone was like, oh my gosh, like, this guy had, whatever, 11 lashings or something like that. And he didn't bleed at all. And so he allowed that to perpetrate throughout the university. So everyone started thinking, like, wow, he's beyond what we are, because he didn't bleed when he got whipped, when in reality he ate like this bark or something before he got whipped, which clotted his blood so it wouldn't like bleed. And so a lot of his antics are kind of grounded in, well, actually I just did this, but then I allowed them to think that I was bloodless. And so much of his history that precedes him was him doing something kind of like that, but more of like the story of him growing from that. And so I thought that was really cool how you kind of get to see the life of Kvothe, and you see how the legend of Kvothe spreads through, honestly, probably some of it is he is very smart, he's very talented, but it's kind of his smarts that allow him to become greater than what he is. And so that's that was a good summary, man. I mean, there's so much in this.
There's a lot in the book.
It's so much, because there's basically, like you said, there's like these different phases of where the plot's going. And the overarching plot, I think, over the entire thing is basically Kvothe's at the university to look for evidence of the Chandrian, which are the people that killed his parents. Like, that's kind of the driving motive for Kvothe, is I want to avenge my family. But what you quickly find out is that nobody believes that these people exist. And so he's basically digging into legends and like myths of old in order to find out if these people, where these people come from and how to find them. And that's why it's so big when you mentioned that he's banned from the archives, because that's the only place he can go to find this information. And so, you know, the book moves in all these phases of like, okay, now Kvothe has to figure out how to get into the archives. Okay, well, now Kvothe has to figure out how to get money. Now Kvothe needs to figure out if he likes Denna or not. Yeah. And so, like, it kind of just...
There's a point where they try and kill him. And
he almost dies at one point. And so, he's certainly an interesting character. And so let's do our initial impacts here. Mine... Like I said, this was given to me and recommended to me by a friend who is super into fantasy. And so I had really high expectations because this guy is a big fantasy reader and consumer. And it was even higher when he said that this is his favorite book. And so I found, first of all, the first thing I discovered was that this book is really easy to read. Like, the language is poetic at times and beautiful, but it's not bogged down with terms, and like I found that it was just an easy flow. There was an easy flow to just the prose, and so I got sucked in really quickly because I wasn't getting bogged down with like, well, what does that mean, or what is that, or like, who's that person, like, why did they call him that? So he does a really good job of introducing the world without bogging you down with terms, and so it's a very vibrant world, and I do think, because I have the collector's edition, that it did add to my experience, because I got to figure out and learn things about the world that Patrick talks about in the book. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed this. I read this book very quickly, even though it is a big book. I read it very quickly because the world, to me, was interesting enough, and the characters are so well developed. Like, the characters feel like real people. They all have distinct personalities, and they all have motives, and they all have a way of talking that makes it interesting. I don't really know how to say that differently, but just the way Patrick writes dialogue for these characters, you feel like you've stepped into an actual conversation between people. And so it's a testament to Rothfuss's writing
You can tell that he took time to write this book. And the next one too, Wise Man's Fear, because I've read both of them. He continues on in the next one, which is like, he's a very good writer. He studied poetry in college, and he says in the book at one point, like when he's talking about when he wrote it, like he wanted to be a poet, but then he discovered like, I wasn't really good at being a poet. So I decided to do, you know, fiction. And so that kind of, you can see that spill over into his writing. Mm-hmm. So what was your initial impact, man, after reading this tome of a book?
Yeah. So I read it at your recommendation, and I honestly, when I first started reading it, I was like, oh, so this is like, is a really long book. I didn't know that this was going to be as long as it was, which is fine. And I started reading it, and I have to be honest, I really enjoyed the beginning of the book, and I kind of slowed down right when K'voth is leaving Tarbian, trying to get to the academy. Like that whole transition of events really slows mm-hmm. down, especially like the first time you meet Denna and all that. It does kind of slow down. And then after he gets into the academy, him getting into the academy is really exciting, but like his beginnings at the academy aren't all that, you know, interesting after his big incident where he gets in trouble in the sympathy class. Mm-hmm. And so it is. There's this pretty slow middle where you feel like, you know, you're always kind of dealing with like, how's K'voth going to come up with the money for a semester? That feels like that takes like the front seat there for a while. But it really does. It picks up a lot once K'voth starts to get into his music. And I thought that was kind of like a big transition point in the story when he gets back into music, when he becomes a musician, when he's able to find a place to play and live. He moves off campus from the school. And I feel like that's when the story gets really interesting, right? There's the attempted murder of him. There's the the lantern place that ends up blowing up that he works at, and he saves the girl's life. And there's a lot of interesting things that happen there. And so one of the things that I enjoy a lot about the book is that oftentimes we read about legendary figures, and what this book really does is it takes what might be mythic, right, and grounds it in reality. So this is basically, so it's coming from the perspective, you kind of already led this a little bit previously, but it is, we're introduced to this mythic figure, K'voth, this legendary figure, and these books seem to be chronicling like the real story of the grounded version of everything that happened within the specific rules that exist within the universe that Rothfuss is writing in. Because, like, for example, when they try to attack him in the streets, he uses, you know, the sympathy to basically cause a flash with the certain elements and rules that are around the atmosphere at the time, and it blinds the guys. And the guys who were attacked by this think that they've been struck by lightning, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's how you begin to see how someone gets the myth built about them, right? Because these people encountered him and they're saying, this guy struck me with lightning. And like you mentioned, he kind of lets those things happen, right? It's advantageous to get these guys to stop hunting him down. Mm-hmm. And I really like that, right? How it's basically the grounding of a legendary figure. And I gotta be honest, like I can't say that there are too many fantasy books that read quite like this one. A lot of them are, you know, at least they make the adventure, the point A to point B, pretty clear from the beginning, where this is, you don't really know what's going to happen. You're not told at the beginning of the story what the end game of the journey really is of this particular book, right? Like, we kind of know where the trilogy is going, based on some things that are said at the beginning, but you don't really know that this is going to be a love story that is anticlimactic. And to be honest, the romance between Denna and Kvothe is disappointing. Another grounding thing, right? Typically, we have the guy who's, you know, the war hero, the romantic, the dragon slayer, all of this, like, that has it all. Whereas this is more a story of, well, he doesn't have anything, you know? And he uses his talents to the best of his ability, but in his personal life, it's really rough. And so just feel like there's not too many books that feel like this. And it's definitely one that I would recommend reading it, especially for those who are looking for a different pace, a different style of fantasy storytelling. Like if you still like magic and dragons and that type of stuff, it's there. But at the same time, this is more, it's more of a story of a kid who's trying to just get what he wants in life. And how it plays out in this fantasy world. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always interested in why, like, this book obviously is highly rated and it gets talked about on Reddit and stuff. But when you think about it in the terms of, like, low fantasy, intermediate, and high fantasy, if, like, you have those three categories where in a low fantasy, not meaning that it's bad, but like the magic is not part of a science. It's like a Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe would be an introductory low fantasy book. There's magic. I don't need to explain it. I don't really even care how it works. I just want magic and like the tropes. And then you have like intermediate, which is probably like more like a Mistborn, where it's like there is magic and it's in a system, but it's easy to understand. And then you have like high fantasy, which is, you know, like once I hate to use Brandon Sanderson for like all these examples, but it's like, you know, the Stormlight Archives. It's it's very steeped in a complex magic system. And so this one, to me, falls in a weird spot because it's kind of intermediary where it's not complex, like the magic system's not complex. It's not really that hard to understand, but it is a high fantasy novel in the sense that there's a lot of grounding in this world. There's rules, there's laws, there's, you know, systems that you can't break without dire consequences. And there's repercussions to even getting close to bending those rules. And so like you kind of have that in this book. And so I always think it's interesting that this one, when it gets, because I've watched, like I said, a lot of YouTube last week. And so I watched a lot of like fantasy reviews and stuff and people's top fives, top tens. This one doesn't get mentioned that much, which is interesting because I think, like you said, it is a great book for people who like fantasy, who are burnt out on the fantasy tropes, that want something a little different, that, you know, I'm tired of like these legendary people and I'm tired of the gods and the superhumans and like we follow a character that, you know, just kind of exists in a world where these things exist. Well, this is the, like you said, the making of a myth. This is the making of a legend. And not to, you know, brush over the fact that there's a whole other story happening with the story of Kvothe. Like, we still have Kvothe at the end with Bast and the Chronicler, and there's something happening in the world. Like, there's something that, like, is attacking them that is, you know, there's this evil rising in the world of the present day that the book takes place, and we know nothing about that. Like, that happens at the beginning of the book. There's these interludes throughout the book where you kind of get a break from the story of Kvothe and you go back to the inn and they kind of talk about some things and then you go back to the story. And I'll say, after the first two books, a little bit of a spoiler, like, you still really don't know what's going on in the world of the inn. Like, you know more about Kvothe and how he is progressing towards this eventual, like, why is Kvothe, who's this legendary person, hiding in an inn in this, like, no-name town? Like, that's kind of the eventual end of all this. So how does he go from the kid at the university to the bartender? You don't that's what this whole story is. But
yeah,
you don't really know what's going on in the world, like yeah, the actual world of the inn. So like there's still much to be desired. There's still much to be talked about because you don't really know. There's so much more to the story. And so yeah, for somebody who likes fantasy that wants something different than just a like tropey fantasy book, this has a lot, a yeah, whole lot in it. Yeah. And Patrick Rothfuss does the work. He puts in the time to build out a living, breathing world that you can look any direction and there's depth to it. And mm-hmm, so that's what I really appreciate about this book. One thing he said in the collector's edition, because he loves Lord of the Rings. That's his inspiration. Loves Lord of the Rings. He said, I always found it interesting in Lord of the Rings that whenever someone would travel anywhere, they always spoke English. Like, I mean, there's the elves, but I guess the Mordor, you know, the orcs had their own language. But like mm-hmm, when the hobbits would travel to another hobbit city, or, you know, when they traveled to like just men, there was never like a different language or a different accent or anything. Yeah, and so yeah, he was like, I wanted to do something more with my world, and I wanted to create different regions and different accents, and just like kind of how our world is. Yeah. Like if I go down south to Kentucky from Pittsburgh, they're going to have an accent. And so he wanted something living and breathing in this world. And so that's just a small example of what the time that Rothfuss puts into this, his books. And so yeah, to me, this is why this is a top five fantasy book for me. And like you said earlier, the Aeolian, the scene with him getting his pipes and playing, that's one of the best scenes I've ever read in a book. Mm-hmm. Not even just fantasy, just the way he wrote that was just amazing. Like if I could ever write just, you know, a paragraph as good as yeah, he writes, like that would be a success to me. But that's one of my favorite scenes in any book ever. If you read the book, read it for that scene alone, because it's incredible.
And if you've ever played an instrument in front of a crowd, you'll really appreciate it.
Yeah, he really paints that picture of what it feels like.
Yeah, because it is, man. It's such an experience that until I read that, it's like, it's just one of those things you just kind of have to do to know what mm-hmm, it's like, right? To
yeah,
you know, because I used to, you know, do like the jazz band in school, right? And that feeling you get when it's time to do your solo. It's like, oh man, that is a good stuff. And I just feel like it really encompasses like the rush of performing mm-hmm, and also the anxiety, because it's both, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's very scary and very exciting all at the same time, and you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And he does a great job of writing that. Like mm-hmm, you feel that yeah, in that scene, and that's why it probably stands out to so many people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's why I chose our image there that we have on our mm-hmm, retrospective today. We got a picture of Kvothe there with the broken string on his lute playing at.
Yep, yep.
Playing so good at the Aeolian. He probably didn't have a sword on his back in the scene, but we'll just let that be for now.
Yeah. He actually doesn't get a sword really until the second book, so
yeah,
that's okay. That's a blending of the two, but it's all right. Yeah. We still love it. We still love it. So
absolutely.
So, unless you have anything else, man, I feel like it's a pretty good discussion on the Name of the Wind.
Yeah, just to close out here and say that this is a book, if you're getting into fantasy, this is a book I would say, if you've only read one other fantasy series, maybe read a couple other books before you jump into this one. You know, cause this is definitely different. But at the same time, if you want something different, this is definitely the book for you. You know, at this point, so many fantasy, books are point A to point B adventures. That's why I really appreciate Name of the Wind. That's why I really appreciate what Sanderson does, because I feel like, you know, even though Sanderson writes at a very, I wouldn't say very low level, but a much lower level than like Patrick Rothfuss, right? He still tries to at least do different things in the genre. But this one, I think this is a special book. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of my lasting impact. I actually don't own a copy of the book, but I will get one. You know, this will be one that I track down. And I like to have books in the house that when my kids are old enough to read some of these, can, you know, slap it on their desk, but here you go. This will change your life.
Yeah.
And this is one of those I feel like this is a good one to hand off to like a senior in high school going off to college.
Mm.
Read this one. This is a good one.
Yeah, a lot of similar themes too, going off to, you know, the university, learning different things. The world Patrick Rothfuss writes, even though in the first book it's pretty self-contained, it's basically Tarbian and the university. Those are the only two places you learn about. Yet when you have a book, or when you have the book, you have a map and you're like, what are all these other places? What are, like, why does he decide to put some cities there and some cities not there? Like, the different regions even have different currencies. Mm-hmm. There's all this depth to the world that you don't get in the first book, which is interesting, because you basically spend the entire book at the university.
Yeah.
And the university very much becomes a world unto itself. But when you look at the map and you want to go, well, I want to know about these other places, you're not going to get that. And you kind of get a little bit more in the second book. He expands a little bit. But even though you're spending only time at the university, there's depth to everything. Everything he writes. He does not waste, honestly, a word or a sentence. Everything has a purpose. It comes back later. Things that are mentioned offhanded often come back either in the same book or honestly in the next book. Some things come back that you're like, oh, I remember when they said that.
Yeah.
So he does not waste scenes. He does not waste characters. He is very purposeful in his writing. And I appreciate that a lot about Patrick Rothfuss. I can't really speak enough of how good of a writer he is. So for anyone who wants something different with brilliant writing, this is the book you should be reading.
Yeah. And one thing I will add, my last thing here, I saw you have it written in our notes. Did you like the character? Did I like Kvothe as a character? I will say this. I enjoyed Kvothe as a character. I would have liked to know a little bit more about present day Kvothe, because I feel like it will just add so much depth to this story. Because that was basically the thing I left. I was like, man, the book kind of leads you to believe like he can't do it anymore, right? Like he's lost his ability to do magic. And I want to know a little bit about what's going on there. So I do. I like the character because he feels very dynamic. And dynamic main characters, as much as we all say we want dynamic characters, sometimes it's easier to write a main character who's flat, and then your side characters are the dynamic ones. But dynamic main character who's likable is sometimes tough to do. And I think Kvothe is a guy who you're always pulling for. But here's my thing. Sometimes I wonder if Patrick Rothfuss likes Kvothe, because oh my gosh, just take the guy through the ringer. I feel like there were so many times when I was reading the book and I was like, man, just another thing, you know, like you do, you really feel bad for the main character. And it just kind of makes you wonder like, man, did Rothfuss just have like a really rough life, or did he have a friend who had a really rough life? Because, man, there's just points in this story where it's like, oh, jeez, just again, another thing.
You really feel it as the reader, because pretty much from the point when his parents are murdered to basically when he gets his pipes, you're like holding your breath for this guy, because you just are waiting for like the shoe's already dropped. You're just waiting for the next pair of shoes to drop on him, because you're just, this guy is getting kicked. Not only kicked, he's getting buried while he's down, man. Yeah. Like, he is just getting all of it thrown at him. And so finally, when he gets his pipes, I remember like breathing a sigh of relief a little bit. He's like, finally, like he can make some money and just live a little bit. But this guy has just been wrecked for the first,
third of the book.
Yeah. And then you're like, oh man, there's still like 300 pages in this thing. What's he going
to do? Yeah. You're like, well, now what's going to happen?
As long as he doesn't lose those pipes.
Just... Right. It's, yeah. And so read this book, read the second book. I mean, the name of, or the Wise Man's Fear is really good too. Yes, there's some slow parts in it. This is epic fantasy. There's going to be slow parts. But yeah, get on this book if you've not read this one.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you next time on Parallel Quest. We will be continuing. Haven't decided which one that is next, but we will be talking about another epic fantasy book next time on Parallel Quest. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.